Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is March 24th, 2023, and this is episode 371. You're listening to Radio Warnerd, patreon.com/Radio Warnerd, where you sign up for the show and the Warnerd newsletters. Anyway, I'm the co-host Mark Ames in Rochester, New York, Monroe County, and I'm on the line with the Warnerd himself, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Butcher, in Glasgow. How's it going there, John?
It's a little better. My mouth no longer feels like someone stuck a roofing nail into it. Just, you know, a regular nail. I'm very grateful for that. I mean, there's nothing as tiring as pain that just goes on and on. Yeah. Can't sleep, can't write anything. I'm working on a newsletter now, by the way, but for a while I couldn't do anything. And I would certainly recommend people in the UK, you know, don't rely on those 5-star rating services, because...
You mean for dentists?
Especially for dentists, because dentists can do you a lot more harm than most restaurants can.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, where do those 5-star ratings come from? I don't think it's that hard to, you know, come up with, I don't know, just invent some name and get some stock photo and be like, best dental service I've ever had. You too? Yeah, me too. All right. So, last episode, well, we thought we were going to have a shorter interview with Seth Harp about his experience and writings about the Iraq War, but it turned out to be such a fascinating interview, we kept it going. So we didn't get to the second part then, which was we were going to talk about our non-combat experience and what the war looked like to two older guys who were in Russia at the time the war broke out and as the war started to build up. And because, you know, it's weird to think this, but when you watch the way people talk about the Iraq War, but by golly, a lot of people that are sort of in our orbit or subscribers or whatever. I mean, they were too young to really have formed, that's how old we are, to have had a real visceral experience, in 2003 as that war happened. But I mean, they've had a visceral experience as they learn more about it later. Yeah. But it has been... Like, I remember in the camp in the 2020, maybe the 2016 as well, and the 2020 Democratic Party primary campaigns, people would call it Hillary and then Biden for supporting the Iraq War. And you get all these surrogates in the media world and the activist world saying, oh, come on, that was so long ago. A lot of people made a mistake. You know, that's history. We moved on from that. It's like, no, we actually haven't. We actually have a key architect from the liberal democratic side of making sure that war happened in power. We have them all over the media. They moved on to Ukraine. Obviously Ukraine's a bit different, but it's still scary.
Yeah, they were part of a very long tradition of pro-war, pro-intervention, self-described liberals. And that goes at least back to the 1940s.
Right. That's something else. I mean, you and I were talking about that before the previous show, I think. Oh, we've talked about it a couple times, actually, in the last week or two, about the whole idea of pro-war liberals. Because when you were growing up, it was just understood that liberals were possibly more pro-activist pro-war than conservative Republicans, than sort of Eisenhower or Nixon Republicans. I mean,
Until 1964, when Goldwater came along and was supposedly in favor of using atomic weapons. But the difference between him and LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the Democratic candidate in 1964, was not that Johnson was anti-war at all. Vietnam was already starting to look like a really bad idea, and it was already clear that Johnson and his administration would never budge in the direction of getting out of Vietnam. But the difference officially, and there was a survey by psychiatrists because, you know, people who'd never seen gold water in their lives diagnosed him from afar. I think that led to a rule for members of the American Association of Psychiatrists that you don't do that, which lasted until Trump, like most rules did. Yeah. But they said the man is not mentally fit to be president. But it was not because he was pro-war. It was because, allegedly, he was pro-nuke. Mm-hmm. And that went too far. B-52s loaded to the gunnels with 500-pound bombs, that was fine. Mm-hmm. But nukes, no. That was irresponsible. So even then, there was nothing like an anti-war official Democratic Party policy. It evolved within the ranks and mostly among younger people because they were pissed off about Vietnam, which was just so obviously stupid that protesting against it started to seem for them, I think, like protesting against the advance of a glacier in the Pleistocene. it did nothing at all. Nobody, right. as far as I knew, understood why LBJ and his administration could not back off from Vietnam, but they could not. And that sank them and did them a lot of harm. So then came the brief period that you have, Mark, have described as the American glasnost in roughly the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And there was an
which
anti-war.
Which was mostly a Democratic Party thing, right?
Yeah, it was kind there was of an anti-war Democratic it, Party. Yeah.
Right.
But
or
it
a wing
didn't
of it anyway. It was fairly dominant. I mean, Scoop Jackson, the infamous, you know, one of the godfathers of neocons, he was a Democrat, but he was a real minority in the Democrat. I mean, he was considered by that time, by the mid-70s, fairly marginal. I mean, he turned out to have a big influence, I guess, but he was fairly marginal, right? I mean, the energy was going the other way at that time.
Right? Yeah, briefly.
Briefly, yes.
But then, I think when Carter refused to bomb Iran, roughly, in 1979-80, that became a liability for the Democratic Party, or so they thought. They went back to not even supporting their own warmongers, but in effect cheering for Reagan for all of his 8 years in power. They didn't really seem to be running campaigns against Reagan. They were just going along with him.
Well, I would say, I guess I remember it a bit differently. I would say they were more confused in a way they aren't at all now. They were sort of like, it was almost like they weren't sure which way the wind was blowing because they had a lot of these people, you know, Biden came to power in that class of 74 Democrats, which was a pretty, you know, by mainstream parties, Democrat Party standards, it was a fairly radical class. It was a backlash to the Vietnam War and wars overseas and CIA stuff and Watergate especially. And Reagan came to power and I think they saw how popular he was getting by being a straight up John Wayne warmonger. Mm. And so they kind of dithered for a while, I think. Like there was a wing that, you know, the Boland Amendment that did restrict, and this was the Democrats that did restrict at least legally what Reagan was allowed to do in Nicaragua. But then they seemed to cheer on other stuff. I mean, they just seemed to cave all the time, basically. So you couldn't say they were anti-war, but you couldn't say they were pro-war. They were sort of dither war or something. I don't know.
I think it partly depended on where the war was happening.
Yeah.
Certainly when Reagan got at least 245 Marines killed in Beirut in 1982, Tip O'Neill, who was the imbecilic leader of the Democrats in Congress, policed the party so that no one would try to make political capital out of that debacle. that yes. Reagan was
classic,
responsible for.
Classic post, I don't know, 1975 Democrat move, right? We yeah. need to cover for the Republicans. That's kind of yeah. a lot of what they did, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's probably just made a bigger impression on me than yes. anything else. So
no, you're right. The first Iraq war, some big name, you know, Democrats did oppose it. Biden, I believe he voted against the resolution. John Kerry definitely did. They, I think at the time, still thought that's where the base was. That's where the popularity was going to be. I think after the first Gulf War and the swift victory, they never really went there again, most of the party. Yeah. But yeah, that kind of sealed it, I think, for them.
Yeah, and that it's interesting you mentioned Scoop Jackson, who's probably most of our audience have never heard of him. He was a right-wing Democrat, Nixon's favorite Democrat, and he became sort of his staff became a nursery
yes.
for many of the people we're going to end up talking about in this episode. Richard Perle worked mm-hmm. for him, and
a lot of the darkness.
Yeah, the groups these people joined were often named for Scoop Jackson,
right?
And they worked really long and hard, and they were dull psychos in that line from mm-hmm. In the Loop. They were very much people who did their homework, served on various boring DC committees, wore a tie every day, and pushed for the war. And it was mm-hmm. not easy at the time because in the meantime, this big thing happened. The USSR had collapsed. And it's hard to believe now, but at the time that led a lot of people to think, oh, okay, we can give up this endless arms race.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not a conclusion that anybody who mattered liked very much.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, going through this again, a key moment, I think, pretty a key moment in document, because I think I brought this up in the past. I feel like it gets forgotten too much. It's the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance. And it leaked. Somebody was so shocked within the Pentagon that they leaked it to the New York Times, and then everybody freaked out. And they claimed to have I'll get to the story, but basically this defense planning guidance, what it is it's a classified strategy document that the Pentagon produces every 2 years, outlines the military strategy, basically the empire strategy, and then defense budgets are sort of built around that. So the first Iraq war, you know, had concluded. There was no enemy anymore there's no Cold War anymore anyway, because yeah. the Soviet Union collapsed. And so people, as you said, the average Joe thought, oh, well, then that's all over and we can wind down, you know, all this massive military spending. Yeah. Reagan and Bush, you know, their defense budgets were insane, the way that they quadrupled under Reagan. But this defense plan, Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, tasked Paul Wolfowitz, his underling, former Scoop Jackson guy, to come up with the new defense planning guidance document. And Wolfowitz then had Scooter Libby, all these names, man, that, like you said, yeah. they all stay there all throughout that time. Khalilzad, you remember?
Afghanistan. Ramzay.
To write this with him. And what they came up with was that the strategy for the U.S. would be from henceforth to make sure that there was no rival to U.S. military power could not only would arise, but even could arise. And so defense spending would have to be such that the U.S. would be so far advanced from any potential rival anywhere that no rival would even think of trying to compete, because it would take them 30 years to even start to catch up to the U.S. militarily. So it would be pointless. And I'll just even quote a little part here. It's just that the goal would be to, quote, prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power. And then as a corollary to that, it called for bringing in all the new Central and Eastern European states and former Soviet states, as many as possible, into security pacts under the U.S. control, basically NATO, to protect them from Russia, which might one day become a hostile power. When this leaked, actually Wolfowitz, funny enough, he got rattled by the bad press and basically said, I didn't approve of this. and Khalilzad got very upset by the way Wolfowitz basically did, you know, that Far Side with the scope, the sniper scope.
Oh,
on
the bear pointing at the other bear.
The bear points at the other bear, yeah. And so he got really upset. But Cheney saw it. So Khalilzad got really down about it. Scooter Libby was hiding. And then Cheney got a hold of it. He said, wow, I like this. He told Khalilzad, quote, you've discovered a new rationale for our role in the world. But the sick thing is, So because this leaked, it created a controversy. And so they said they were going to go back and soften it. And what Libby did was he actually made it far more radical. From we shouldn't allow a rival to arise to we shouldn't even allow the possibility of a rival to rise within decades. But this has been strategy. I mean, let's be honest. This has been strategy ever since.
One thing that always strikes me, and I've part of reading the comment sections is occasionally trying to intervene in comment threads under various pseudonyms, which I have tried at length. And one thing you find out is average people are gullible as they come when it comes to defense budgets. Mm-hmm. You will say, you know, how come you only get 4 F-35s for $1 billion. Freedom isn't free. I mean, that's the level of response. I think they had been so well trained by decades of Cold War that they responded like Pavlov's dogs. They, you know, you rang a defense bell and they barked.
Yeah.
So those guys were just exploiting that. I mean, if you're dealing with a bunch of suckers, and they'll give you their money without even needing a good story, you're going to do it.
Yeah. You know, one other thing that sort of happens at this time, we'll talk about it a little bit, I think, is that, I mean, if you were to kind of describe the rationale for military and covert operation interventions around the world by the U.S., and there were, you know, countless of them during the Cold War, the guiding ideology that rallied public support was anti-communism. I mean, anti-communism. So, you know, folks would call that a negative ideology. And they really wanted to do it to also promote a positive one. But the positive one, which would be spreading capitalism, people aren't as much willing to die for that. But the fear of communism was genuinely an organizing principle, a successful one. Since Carter started to change that some, it started with Carter, kind of got murkier under Reagan, but then really reemerged later. Promoting democracy promotion has been a really effective organizing, mobilizing force for war interventions, covert and overt, since then. And but it didn't really come into its own until after the end of the big Cold War. I mean, it starts in the 90s, you know, democracy promotion and human rights and that whole thing, the liberal intervention.
Yeah. Even human rights has a kind of comprehensible meaning to it. Democracy,
yes.
I really don't know. I mean, I've lived in New Zealand for 10 years. I lived in the U.S. for 10 years. Which is more democratic? I have no idea. Couldn't get decent drugs either place. That's one thing. At least I had health care in New Zealand. It's an endlessly complex thing, but when you reduce it to democracy, it seems to mean something to most people. It really doesn't mean much of anything. And as you say, it works. But the interesting thing is, during this time of the supposed peace dividend, defense budgets in Western Europe did go down. Russian defense budgets did go down. At that time, the Chinese defense budget was so negligible.
Negligible.
It wasn't worth mentioning. The U.S. remained flat in the early 90s and then zoomed after 9/11.
And it didn't go down as much. I seem to remember there was always this fight about it, that the U.S. defense budget went down, but it never went down as much as people hoped or wanted it to. I remember a lot of articles also about, like, the CIA, like, what's its mission anymore? I mean, even Patrick Moynihan, who was Nixon's other favorite Democrat, was in the early 90s calling for abolishing the CIA. And people wondering, like, what's its role anymore? Nobody asked that anymore after 9/11.
Yeah.
But yeah, and you know, the whole thing about Saddam Hussein as the great enemy. I mean, they were looking for enemies to justify all this. And, you know, Saddam Hussein was the enemy, the top enemy for one faction. And Milosevic started to become the top enemy for another faction. And they were both, you know, vying for the Hitler of the Year, you know, award in Washington. Or they were both Hitlers at the same time. I don't know. But you did get a lot of that in the media.
I mean, Milosevic was easier to deal with. You could do him as a quick errand, and they did, because Serbia was just about exhausted and bled out. They still managed to lose a stealth fighter, but it went quickly. Iraq was supposedly a much bigger project, but people started working. These are people who do their homework, who stay in place, as we said, work really hard. So in 1997, Bill Kristol, as you said, Mark, single-handedly destroyed his dad's reputation, decades of worming his way into the right wing in D.C., and eventually destroyed his whole movement's reputation. Yeah. In 97, he wrote Saddam Must Go, a how-to guide. And that was in the Weekly Standard. I think you understand the Weekly Standard better than I do.
The Weekly Standard was set up and financed by Rupert Murdoch as a nursery of ideas, of bad neocon ideas. Right at the same time that he put this out, this was the same year that he and Robert Kagan founded the Project for a New American Century, which was really like also a think tank incubator for everything that was going to come under the Bush era. Yeah. But again, it's sort of founding ideas very similar to that Pentagon strategy document. The goal was to promote global American leadership. American leadership is basically American domination. And of course,
I think domination is more like it, because this was sort of barely concealed urge to terrorize the world. I mean, that's really what there's this quote from I'm not sure how to pronounce his name correctly, but Raoul Marc Gerecht, who was briefly a big name in the PNAC. It's an astonishing quote, but it's very typical of how people were talking at the millennium in DC. Quote, "We have no choice but to reinstill in our foes and friends the fear that attaches to any great power. Only a war against Saddam Hussein will decisively restore the awe that protects American interests abroad and citizens at home." That passed without any flinch at the time, but it's really remarkable to reinstill in our foes and friends the fear. We have to frighten our friends.
Yeah. And all they do is think we're a bunch of freaking weirdos. And, you know, they're right. That's the thing. I mean, so much American power is in spite of these people, but they're the only ones who really want to use it. Worst ways. So, you know, that's what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. American power for so many decades was cool cars and Bugs Bunny. Yeah. And all that worked a lot better.
But it's also important to note, so among the directors of the PNAC was Bruce Jackson. This is kind of an important character. Bruce Jackson, he was the main architect of the lobbying effort in the 90s to expand NATO. I mean, he was recognized by everybody as the guy who pushed through expanding NATO. He also moonlit as a VP for Lockheed, so it worked out well for him both ends.
Yeah.
But he was really the guy that that pushed it through. And there was a lot of opposition, even in like the New York Times editorial pages, because they all kind of understood this is the defense companies who have lost contracts from the scaling down of the of defense budgets looking for new markets. And all it's going to do is create an enemy out of Russia, which will then justify the expansion of NATO. I mean, when you look back, that's what they said. And I think what's interesting is 2 years later, so that's 1997, right? And then 1999, a couple of big things happened. One is the NATO war in Kosovo, which we're still living with the consequences of it. I'm not saying that Serbia, I mean, what Serbia was doing to Albanian, ethnic Albanians in Kosovo was absolute repression, but you can make a bad situation worse for the world by doing what the U.S. and its allies did, which is they tried to get U.N. Support for military action. The U.N. refused to give it. And so NATO decided to bomb anyway. And this was the template, very openly, the template for the war in Iraq. I mean, Richard Holbrook, he very openly, when he argued for the invasion of Iraq in 2003, he said, we already set the precedent in 1999 with the bombing of Kosovo. So it's out there. You don't need UN support. You do it because we're right. And that's it.
But and there's another angle that really fits in with the threat of the peace dividend, which is, I wrote a big newsletter called NATO and Autobiography a while ago. And the thing that really shocked me was NATO's first military action as NATO was in the first Gulf War, that is 1991, and then in Kosovo. That is, NATO, as all of us living under it understood, or thought we understood, was a way of containing the Soviet threat. But NATO's first military actions did not come until the Soviet threat had already evaporated.
Right.
Which suggests something else was going on.
Other things that were really important about the Kosovo War, I mean, and seeing this from Russia, seeing Western reporters. So I remember a lot of Western reporters coming over to Russia. So throughout the 1990s, Americans in particular and some other Westerners had this absolute missionary zeal in Russia to transform Russia into our image, aping the same ideas about neoliberal ideas about free markets, democracy, and all this stuff, and then seeing what we wanted to see and completely missing what was actually happening there. And then everything collapsed. So then at the end of 1998, because what was actually happening in Russia was, you know, a catastrophe, an economic and political absolute nightmare and catastrophe, as we've talked about, the financial system completely collapsed. It was the greatest financial system collapse in decades at that time. And then the American missionary, the mission was dead. And then a few months later, the Americans, first they started asking themselves, God, what do we do wrong? How could we not see it? Then they decided, actually, we were right. We were good. Our intentions were good. It was the Russians were bad. They didn't listen to us. They didn't take our medicine. And then they found this real mission, this new mission, which was to fight fascism in Kosovo, just like the Greatest Generation did in World War II, to fight fascism, to save refugees and fight fascism. And I swear to God, no one believed in this more than the media class. It was so strange to see all these people like activated, people I knew in the media world talking like they were the new George Orwells. And, you know,
Homage to Catalonia sense?
Yeah, absolutely, in the homage to Catalonia sense, yes. And this was a really big deal because in the 90s, I think two movies that had a huge impact on sort of boomers, particularly, and maybe a certain part of Gen Xers, but definitely boomers, was first Schindler's List above all. Schindler's List had a, I wasn't there. I'm only remembering this after kind of going back over time, like realizing, yeah, Schindler's List had a huge cultural, political influence on people who were interested in politics in any way. And then Saving Private Ryan. So, you know, people, whereas they looked as, at their real lives in the 90s and it was like, oh, we're going to talk about Monica Lewinsky and, you know, the contract with America. Things seemed so dull. People, a lot of people with big educations and big media jobs really relished the idea of having this, what appeared to be historical purpose. You know, without seeing what the Kosovo precedent set, which is you can now bomb another country and carve out a new state. I mean, we set the precedent, you know, you could bomb a sovereign country illegally, and it was illegal, and it was a war of aggression, which is the number one crime. And, you know, and use the pretext of internal repression to do it. And, you know, the Russians and Putin, they refer to it all the time. In fact, that was the first time in that whole decade when Americans were involved in so much destruction in Russia, but Americans were loved up until the bombing of Serbia. And that was the first time I ever saw publicly Russians really turning both scared and angry at America.
Well, I remember the, what was the airport they evacuated under pressure?
Pristina? Yeah, Pristina.
I remember that moment as a deep humiliation among all Russians.
Yeah.
And Yeltsin just seemed to exemplify that humiliation. Yep. I mean, of course he did. Of course he shamed us. He was their creature, and he groveled to them. But you know that there's a weird cultural moment, speaking of cultural stuff here, that occurred, I guess, in the early 90s, mid-90s. There was a flash in the pan band called, believe it or not, James, this sort of British pop band. And they had a song that was supposedly about the Berlin Wall coming down, and it was watching the world wake up from history. And one of the lines was, Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about. And it was kind of not just yearning to be the greatest generation, but envy and sullen resentment of the boomers as well. Like,
yeah, no, you all had a purpose, but look at us. But it wasn't very thrilling. I mean, what did the fall of the wall do? Well, I mean, it gave people a place to move to be expats for a while, but it didn't. I mean, it ushered in, you know, neoliberalism and shock therapy, and that wasn't very satisfying spiritually. Yeah. Like, okay, so now they have more goods than they used to have. Wow, you know, now they can make market choices in the marketplace. Like, yeah. So, but another thing. So, another thing I want to bring up here. So, 1999. So after that, you know, the Russian kind of deep state establishment, or as fractured as it was, totally flipped out over this. And, you know, eventually, pretty quickly, this leads to Yeltsin appointing Putin, you know, his FSB chief, as his prime minister. He tried a different FSB guy, ex-KGB guy, Stepashin, that didn't work, to get a war on it in Chechnya. And the war in Kosovo had a lot of influenced very much the conduct of Russia's second Chechen war. We've talked about that in the past, particularly how it managed information. But here's kind of one of the things I wanted to get to. In 1999, the same crowd that put together the Project for a New American Century, so this is 2 years later, the Chechen war starts. And this is the only place in the whole Muslim world they actually shed a tear for. They launch a new committee called, or a new huge sort of, you know, committee called the American Committee for Peace in Chechnya. It's chaired by Brzezinski, who's openly talked about how, you know, the big goal is to bring Eurasia permanently under U.S. power.
Yeah, and who said, compared to crushing Russia, which he means in a good way, isn't that glorious? What are a few angry Muslims?
Yeah, he meant that by helping create al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, It's chaired by Brzezinski and Al Haig, noted peacenicks. And then its directors included Bill Kristol, James Woolsey, Robert Kagan, same people, Elliot Abrams, all the peaceniks, Richard Perle, and then Bruce Jackson, who's the guy that expanded NATO. Now he's basically in a committee to try to support the Chechen rebels and pin down Russia. And then the next, a couple of years later, when Bush comes to power, Bush asks him to start up a committee for the liberation of Iraq, which he did. So he started up the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which was the main lobbying group then for war with Iraq. So there's, you can see just kind of like a neat line there.
And then this part of the history everyone knows very well, so we can move through it quickly to the results. The Republicans win, or at least straight arm, I grab the ball from the Democrats because they want it more. In 2000, they win the presidency, and 9/11 happens, and that's everybody's license to go insane. And as everybody used to say, there was a movie about Sean Hannity in Salt Lake City where he gets all these smart-ass questions in an auditorium, and every time he just does this brain-dead smirk and says, what you don't understand is 9/11 changed everything. He can say that 200 times in a row, and he does in this movie. And it is the ultimate answer to any quibbles. Yeah. You can do whatever you want.
But you're right. Again, it had that – it was – for mostly a kind of different audience, but it was this, I have a mission now. I have a purpose in life. There was so much of that going around when 9/11 happened. I was in Kentucky that year. You were in New Zealand. So I wasn't in Russia. It was strange because I have to admit I had no visceral reaction at all. Like, I wasn't for it. You know, I'm not for the bombing thing. It was kind of stunning to watch it on TV, but I saw these people all psyched up and telling me that they had a purpose. I was belonged to a YMCA. I remember guys talking about how, this has been prophesied in the Bible and this, we're paying for our sins and this, but we now have a purpose. Like, there was a lot of that, at least out in Kentucky where I was, but it was all over the place. Even liberals in New York City, also, everyone just suddenly had a purpose and kind of thought, everything's going to change. America's going to change. It's going to be more serious. We're all going to bind together. And nothing really fucking changed, in that sense anyway.
But you're right. There was a feeling that we have been scourged and this will make us more virtuous.
Yes.
But I felt that in New Zealand too. I could see it in the interviews. But actually, just to describe briefly what happened in New Zealand, it was like I heard it on the car going in that morning. And the big news, because this is a very sporting country, is will the Olympics go on after these attacks in New York City? And apparently they would go on. So I do my usual health breakfast, like a giant bottle of Coke and a cream cake thing at this 7-Eleven kind of place. I go into my office because I was always the first one there in the morning because of goddamn med students. And then I have to go to my various TAs' rooms. They're called tutors, but they amount to TAs. And the funniest thing was everybody had commandeered every TV they could get, and we had several sets because we were videoing student speeches in this class. And there was a really avid, happy audience around the TVs. I don't think it was American, and I don't think in all cases it was anti-Americanism, let me put it that way. I think it was just like, oh boy, look at this.
Something's happening.
When I came in, because I was standing for America, everybody would be grabbing for the remote and trying to turn it off and saying, oh, sorry. Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. And I didn't want to hear it. I, much as you were saying, I didn't feel very much about it at all, except bitterly, frankly, I was thinking, God damn it, this never happened to London. We're so slack.
Yeah. It's funny. So I didn't feel that feeling. I didn't feel endangered being in Kentucky. Like, okay, you know, yeah, they went after the two largest buildings in the biggest city. You know, that doesn't have much to do with me. But I think the anthrax attacks, which are still a big giant mystery after all these years, those felt a little bit, those caused, as I recall, kind of more granular level middle American fear, because it suddenly seemed like, I don't know, the state didn't have control over things at all, and anybody could get it at any time. And then, of course, there were people fanning those fears for their own reasons. I mean, you know, we famously know about all the neocons.
Yeah. And a large part of the American people thought the state was doing it, right? They're always ready to believe that. In a way, it's a reassuring conclusion because it suggests that someone really is in charge. But after that, there was a weird contained vengefulness or a channeled vengefulness. The people who mattered channeled the rage in the direction they wanted, which was Iraq and Afghanistan and the defense budget. There were other manifestations, like a bunch of Sikhs got beat up because idiots thought Muslims wear turbans because, I don't know, they read Little Orphan Annie comics or something. But that was strongly disapproved. What was approved was... yeah, very greatest generation militarized vengefulness, purposeful, quiet, though not that quiet, and effective. That was strongly admired. We were supposed to be more Roman.
Yeah,
I think Victor Davis Hanson was saying, be more Roman or something. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there was that sense, too, among a lot of scared and or kind of excited, even sort of centrists and liberals and, you know, city slickers, that they were almost kind of happy that the Bush administration people were in power. I mean, maybe Bush himself was a problem. They were trying to convince themselves that he had Churchillian, you know, rhetorical abilities, if you remember some of that. Yeah. But they were happy, nevertheless, to have dad-like grown-ups who were dad-like in their minds, like the conservative dad that they once rebelled against that they now are glad is in power, you know, they're in power. Powell, Rumsfeld, Cheney, of course.
Strong disciplinarians.
Yeah, strong disciplinarians. You know, of course, it turned out Rumsfeld is just an unbelievable doofus. Like just that Steve Carell depiction of him in Vice was just so great, so perfect. Just a dumb frat boy, with a lot of ambition.
I mean, if you heard our interview with Seth Harp, he clearly still remembers with resentment Rumsfeld's smart mouth comment, which he made to a bunch of serving military people. Well, you know, you don't go to war with the army you want. You go to the war with the army that you have. And this was in response to a question about why can't we have decent helmets, you know, or something like that. So they were not an impressive cast. I remember, and this is an important question, because when we talk about media coverage of the war, one question that I at least obsess on is, did they know they were lying, and did they just feel that it was for the good of the country that they had to say certain things? Like, everybody talked about George W. Bush's heroic conduct in the aftermath of 9/11. The problem was that was on video, and he was sitting there reading My Pet Goat to a group of elementary school kids. I didn't make him do that. He decided to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything about him. It's just he was actually reading My Pet Goat to a bunch of elementary school kids.
Yeah.
And he gets a little mumble in the ear from what is presumably a Secret Service guy.
No, it was Andrew Card, I think, one of his advisors. Okay.
And he does a sort of a meme before it was a meme. You know, the one of that of that stuffed toy that looks to the side and then looks back with his beady little eyes. He's like, what do I do now? I and then he goes back to reading My Pet Goat. And they somehow made – then he flies to an undisclosed
bunker. Yeah, then he's Snagglepussed. I mean, this is the whole thing. It's like that could have actually been his moment. He could have flown to the Pentagon or to New York City, you know, like that – absolute freak Giuliani went down there, and that made him, you know, somebody who's an absolute freak. It made him into a hero for 10 years that took people to get over that. Like, he could have done that and taken a little, small little chance, tiny chance.
Small chance, yeah.
But instead,
I mean, Zelensky
went,
does that.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not that hard. The risk is not that much, but it must feel great.
Yes.
And Bush was too weak or too outright cowardly.
I couldn't get over that, man. I have to admit, that really shocked and pissed me. I was in the country at that time. And then to hear people saying, oh, wow, he's really, you know, he's going to do something. He's mad. Yeah. And he's like, are you kidding me? This guy fled and hid in a hole. Like, you know, I mean, everyone trashed Saddam for hiding
for,
in a hole.
For hiding a hole. Yeah.
Yeah, like, he actually had something to be scared about. But, you know, that was pathetic, man.
Yeah, and they lied. They just outright lied. That's what I wonder. And I honestly wonder even now, like, when people wrote about Bush's courage in the aftermath of 9/11. Did they know they were lying, or did they just invent a courageous Bush to match the needs of the moment?
My guess is the marketing people, the Roves or whatever, knew they were lying. And these are people that really get a thrill from lying cleverly and having it succeed. So that's one class. But the other people who carry on the lie, what they know is there are lies that people want to believe, and they're not going to question them, even though their own eyes might have told them something differently. They want to believe it. And I can tell you, everybody wanted to believe that they had a brave president. Because what other purpose is there of having a dumb Texan?
Yeah.
Except that he's supposed to be brave, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's a ritual king. He's supposed to stand up at the head of the army or at the podium and look brave. He couldn't even manage that.
Yeah. That was just unbelievable. But the ability to lie to yourself, I mean, you know, that's the question with the whole lead up to the Iraq war. Did people believe what they were writing? And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, did people believe Russiagate as they were doing it? We just saw this, right? So we've seen various versions of this where everyone whips each other up into lies and you get rewarded for it. So I don't know. The brain is a strange thing. It's the brain can be like, well, I'm getting a reward by pressing this button. You know, a little treat comes out, and this is the lie, but whatever. And the other button, which is the truth, you know, I press it and I don't get anything, or I get a problem, so I'm going to keep pressing the lie. Like, it...
Well, the few people who did tell the truth paid for it.
Yeah.
And I'm not a Bill Maher fan, but he did at least lose his job after 9/11 by saying, well, you can call these guys a lot of things, but you can't call them cowards. They gave their lives for this, and they knew they were giving their lives.
Phil
Nobody
Donahue.
Argued with him about that. They just fired him.
Yeah, Phil Donahue, man. That was a big name when I was younger.
Oh, yeah.
He was like Oprah Winfrey, but and then moved into politics, and he got fired. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. But after that, once 9/11 had sunk in, there was a really interesting move, which was part of what became the genesis of the War Nerd Project, which you and I invented in Moscow around 2002, partly because I was so furious that I'd spent my entire wretched adolescence in the reference rooms of libraries looking up Jane's weapons. And now suddenly people who'd been, in my mind, having a really great time were now claiming to be military pundits. And it was driving my rage through the roof. So we tried to come up with Gary Brecher as a character to embody that resentment. But some of the stuff they came up with was astonishing, even by the hysterical standards that prevailed in America after 9/11. Here's a story from Newsweek in the weeks just before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. And one of the problems, by the way, in Afghanistan is the USAF said, we can't hit anything there. It's nothing but a bunch of mud huts. It's not worth our time. So anyway, here's the story. Days after 9/11, a senior Pentagon official lamented the lack of good targets in Afghanistan and proposed instead U.S. military attacks in South America or Southeast Asia as a surprise. As a surprise to the terrorists. Well, yes, that would surprise. The unsigned top secret memo, which appears to have been written by Defense Undersecretary Douglas Feith, who was called by Tommy Franks the dumbest fucking guy on the planet, is one of several Pentagon documents uncovered which advance unorthodox ideas for the war on terror. The memo suggested hitting targets outside the Middle East in the initial offensive or a non-Al-Qaeda target. Mm-hmm. The memo's content, Newsweek has learned, was in part the product of ideas from a two-man Pentagon intelligence unit appointed by Feith after 9/11. They argued that an attack on terrorists in South America, for example, a remote region on the border of Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil, where intelligence reports said Iran-backed Hezbollah had a presence, would have ripple effect on other terrorist operations. Wow. The proposals were floated to top foreign policy advisors, but White House officials stressed they were regarded warily and never adopted. Now, okay, this is the most amazing thing in the world.
Yeah.
The Pantanal is one of the great swamps of the world, like maybe the greatest living swamp of the world now. And it was a big part of the action in the War of the Triple Alliance, so we've studied it before. But the idea that what would really surprise these people in Afghanistan and Iraq is if we hit Hezbollah, which had absolutely nothing to do with any of it, in the Pantanal. Like, first of all, you have to believe that Hezbollah is hunkered down, you know, with the storks and the caimans in the Pantanal. It's like the caimans are going to say, oh, these Americans, like, oh, they're tougher than we thought. Yeah. Okay, we got to get the word back to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah, suck. But remember the famous Tom Friedman line, you know, we went in there and we showed them and we said, hey, suck on this. You remember that one?
It's Tom Friedman in a street fight. That's really
they
hilarious.
Love being they're, tough. They were all like that for a while, though. I mean, that quote that you quoted from that neocon about, we're going to make even our friends fear us and respect us. It's like people who watch these old Roman, you know, they didn't care about being loved. They wanted to be feared and respected. Yeah. Ooh, I want to be feared,
with a soundtrack of tramping feet and sort of metal noises.
Yeah. Oh, they're so dumb. That's funny, though, because this is classic Rumsfeld. I mean, again, there was that time, probably because he wore glasses and he looked like a dad or something, and people wanted to believe that he was considered one of the intellectual brains of the Bush administration. And he would say things essentially like, you know, we need to think outside the box here. And then so, and that was such corporate thinking. Okay, we got to think outside the box. Let's think outside the box. Doug, Faith, or Dave, why don't you get some of your guys together and you think outside the box. It's like, where is the least likely place? This is so outside the box. Where is there for sure not a single terrorist who would do anything? It's like, you know, here's a swamp. Nobody's lived there for 1,000 years. Let's bomb that place. That'll show them.
It's incredible. I mean, somehow that takes me back to the old hippie days where I was reading Iron Butterfly's one album, Inagata DeVita. They were a one-hit wonder. And it was the usual four white guys group. And on the back cover, there were photos of the four of them. And little capsule descriptions, and one of them read, "Steve is the deep thinker of the group." Even at 15, I thought, ah, come on.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's pretty sad. Just somewhere south, you know, the global south. right. So, yeah, it was, I mean, these were the people who were supposed to be the brains. But it's so strange. Like, there's no brain power at all, but they're somehow reliable for something else. I mean, they're.
Yeah. I suppose they'll show up on Meet the Press. They live within half an hour of the studios, whatever.
Absolutely. And they watch it religiously. It's funny. Yeah. You know, do people watch those shows anymore, Face the Nation and Meet the Press? I'm sure somebody does still and definitely did. Those shows mattered. They were kind of newsmaker shows for a while. I mean, that's where Cheney would come to drop his latest disinformation, you know, about the connections between Al-Qaeda and Saddam or, you know, nuclear weapons.
Well,
and Saddam.
But magazines like Weekly Standard weren't meant for the commoners, right? They were meant to be circulated among the nomenclatura, but
Washington. That was it. Yeah, they were meant to, it was for Washington, D.C. and a Acela corridor audience and meant to represent a faction. And, you know, look, I mean, the neocons, they had an ideology, which is, you know, this imperialist, like out and out imperialist, more imperialist than anybody else. But they also had an ideology that connected them to a major power interest, which was the weapons industry and the Pentagon and the whole national security state. Like they made sure that it's not like they came up with these ideas out in and sort of floated them just out there to write clever articles. I mean, they were essentially representing the weapons industry. So today you still have, you know, that Institute for the Study of War. I mean, that's a Kagan joint, and it's backed by all the big defense companies. That's how it works.
Well, before we move on from 9/11 and the aftermath, I want to give a plug to our sound genius, Brendan Enderegg. We were talking about 9/11 a moment ago, and Brendan has done the sound for two shows on the History Channel about 9/11. One of them is called 102 Minutes That Changed America. And Brendan did the sound by making a sort of collage of real sound clips from the moment-by-moment experience of 9/11. It sounds amazing. That's Brendan Enderegg, 102 Minutes That Changed America on the History Channel. And the other one is 9/11, The Days After, about how America reacted in the days and weeks after 9/11. Yeah, I'm actually going to watch that one, 102 Minutes. I'd like to see somebody make music out of it.
Yeah. Real quickly, because it is so amazing. You actually never, ever, ever get tired of it, and nobody should. Do you want to listen to that clip of Thomas Friedman telling Charlie Rose, you know, we went into Iraq to tell him to suck on this?
Yeah, yeah.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
Well, I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. And it's interesting to talk about it here in Silicon Valley, because I think looking back at the 1990s, I can identify that there are actually three bubbles of the 1990s. There was the NASDAQ bubble. There was the corporate governance bubble. And lastly, there was what I would call the terrorism bubble. And the first two were based on creative accounting. The last was based on moral creative accounting.
Whoa.
The terrorism bubble that basically built up over the 1990s said, flying airplanes into the World Trade Center, that's okay. Wrapping yourself with dynamite and blowing up Israelis in a pizza parlor, that's okay. Because we're weak and they're strong and the weak have a different morality. Having your preachers say that's okay, that's okay. Having your charities raise money for people who do these kinds of things, that's okay.
Let me guess. That's
okay. Having your press call people who do these kind of things martyrs, that's okay. And that built up as a bubble, Charlie. And 9/11 to me was the peak of that bubble. And what we learned on 9/11 in a gut way was that that bubble was a fundamental threat to our open society. Because there is no Walheim, no INS agent smart enough, no metal detector efficient enough to protect an open society from people motivated by that bubble. And what we needed to do was go over to that part of the world, I'm afraid, and burst that bubble.
I'm afraid.
We needed to go over there, basically, take out a very big stick, right in the heart of that world, and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. Because part of that bubble said, we've got you. This bubble is actually going to level the balance of power between us and you because
God, it's metaphors.
We don't care about life. We're ready to sacrifice, and all you care about are your stock options and your Hummers. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this.
Okay? Oh, now I'm scared.
That, Charlie, was what this war was about.
All right. Yeah, that's what this bubble.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tom Friedman, street thug. All right.
Yeah, it was that sort of Acela corridor pseudo street thug talk that gave rise to the Warnerd as a response to those phonies. I mean, absolute phonies. And they were, I mean, deadly phonies, but phonies, right? Yeah. Frightening, deadly phonies. They all have that tone of voice too. They're kind of like Jeffrey Gettleman's. It's that same nursery school teacher's voice.
Yeah. I think we need to say, suck on this, you know?
What part of this sentence do you not understand? Wow. I mean, I think I've said this before, but I rode on a train on an Amtrak once with Friedman. And he is, you know, you hear this sometimes about like celebrities, but he's really small. I mean, really not just small, but like, I don't know, diminutive, with this large head, really tiny shoulders, and this like large, you know, his head, it's sort of like it's been inflated like twice the size, with this huge mustache. And he just always looks like he's thinking to himself, like, what contemporary cliches that I learned on the last golf outing can I spin for a new story about geopolitics, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he just, God, and those metaphors, the bubble, you know, there's this bubble and that bubble, and you need to take a stick.
The bubble and the stick. Honestly, you've got to imagine a Looney Tunes cartoon character with a big bubblegum bubble, and then somebody comes up with a sharp stick.
Yeah. Whack. But he didn't even allow for a nail or a needle in that stick, just a stick. God bless him. And he's, of course, still with us, still pontificating. So let's talk a little bit, I think, about the actual lead up to the war here.
Yeah, the chronology of the war. Yeah. I mean, there were two invasions that had to be done in the minds of the administration. One made immediate sense to most people at the time, made less and less sense as the years went on, but at the time it made sense. Al-Qaeda was based in southern Afghanistan, so doing something to Afghanistan made sense to most nationalist Americans, and that began really quickly with a bombing campaign maybe 20 days after 9/11. Very quick response. And that, at this stage, was mostly a proxy war. But it was clear that this war was sort of demanded by the public, and what really interested the administration was going into Iraq, except that was a lot harder to explain, and they had to work really hard at it for a really long time. So 2001 to 2003 was devoted to persuading the American public, such as it was, that there was good reason to go into Iraq. because a lot of people thought, well, they were in Afghanistan, and we bombed Afghanistan. They're on the run now. And then later, by the way, they've gotten away now. We didn't capture Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. We didn't capture Osama because, as it turned out, he was safely in the hands of our Pakistan administration allies. So whatever, we've at least installed a different government in Afghanistan. That's done, but not at all. The point was to do the transition to Iraq, and that's where it got weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just remember thinking, again, watching this from Russia, for a while, thinking they can't be serious. I mean, like, it was so clear they were inventing, they were just propagandizing and inventing something. And it you know, you learn, and again, this happened with Russiagate as well, that as Grady Fring would say, volume, volume, volume. I mean, if you flood the airwaves, flood people's heads with the inevitability of it or something, and don't allow for any real space outside of it, that, I don't know, you can make it happen.
You mentioned in a tweet that Washington Post ran 140 front-page articles promoting an Iraq invasion, 27 editorials pushing for the war in the 6 months leading up to the invasion.
Yeah,
the invasion happened on March 20th, 2003. And, of course, nobody at Washington Post was fired or disciplined in any way.
No. Fred Hyatt. I mean, so Fred Hyatt, who was the Russia correspondent in the Yeltsin years, got everything totally wrong. You know, he was blowing Yeltsin, blowing the new oligarchs as baby billionaires, just trying to normalize the country, completely blindsided by the financial collapse. And what happens next? He gets kicked up to probably the single most influential, certainly editorial page job in the world. The editorial page, the house editorials in the Washington Post have enormous pull on, you know, Capitol Hill. They do. And
it's a company newspaper in a company town.
Yeah. And then he gets that completely wrong and literally stayed there until he died on the job, what, a year or two ago. I think he died sort of young, strangely enough. And the guy who took over is just carrying on. You wouldn't even know. It's like chatbot GPT or, you know, Hyatt chatbot GPT. He's just putting out the exact same editorials with the exact same party line, same crap. You know, another line to, before I, we can't forget this. We were talking about the tough guy craziness of these neocons and the Bushies and stuff. This was a famous one, and this got sort of forgotten. Ron Suskind, the journalist, first published this in the New York Times Magazine in 2004. Of course, they started publishing this stuff when the war started going bad. Then you could start telling the truth. And he talked about a discussion he was having with a top Bush aide in the White House about something or other. And it's thought that it's Karl Rove, but it's never been 100% confirmed. And this person, this unnamed top Bush political advisor, said to Suskind, here, I'll just quote from the article. The aide said that guys like me were, quote, in what we call the reality-based community, unquote, which he defined as people who, quote, believe that solutions emerge from your judicious study of discernible reality, unquote. I nodded and murmured something about enlightenment principles and empiricism. He cut me off, quote, that's not the way the world really works anymore, he continued. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do. I mean, the boasting, you know, the dorky, nerdoid boasting here, but like, with real teeth behind it, you know, with this giant arsenal behind it. So weird, weird fucking people.
Oh, yeah, very. I mean, and as you're implying, the level of nerdiness here is really clear to anybody who grew up scared of everybody on the playground, but then went home to read about Alexander the Great. I'm not talking about myself, of course. I was the lead in
well-adjusted.
But my elementary school's water polo team, personally. But that does happen a lot. And there's a reason that Bush called Rove Turd Blossom. this would be like Turd Blossom's revenge.
Yes, Turd Blossom going, yeah, that's really funny, sir. And then going in, all right, Susskind, listen to this. You, I make reality. You are nobody.
Yeah, somehow it reminds me of that god-awful Rob Reiner movie, A Few Good Men.
Yes.
Because I think that was a 1990s movie. And I remember thinking at the time, what the hell happened to these people's minds?
I know. People love that line. You can't handle the truth. Yeah. Everybody is that guy now. You can't handle. No, you can't handle the truth. No, both of yous can't handle the truth. I can handle the truth. Like
it's about strangling some guy who doesn't fit into the gung-ho little clique, and that's somehow heroic. I don't get it. And then Jack Nicholson as the nationalist. Epitome of self-sacrifice. That was a bit of a stretch too. But the whole thing just seemed weird and gratuitous at the time. Like, I don't know what's happened to these people, but it does show, I think, that there was the will to be part of some vaguely fascistic, nationalistic movement long before 9/11 came along and gave them a reason.
Right. Absolutely. So let's continue on with the lead up to the war here and some of the other things. I mean, look, we haven't really talked about the New York Times as much. They were at least as guilty of bringing this war into reality. You know, Judy Miller and Michael Gordon famously co-wrote these pieces falsely, you know, just horribly sourced pieces, falsely claiming that Saddam was building nukes. And then Cheney would go on. Cheney's people would hand it to them, and then they would publish it in the New York Times, and then Cheney would go on Face the Nation or Meet the Press and say, my God, did you read what I just dumped into the New York Times this morning? I got to do something about what I just dumped. You know?
Yeah, I happened to read this thing that my staffer, Libby, just wrote for me.
I know. It's just amazing. Michael Gordon, by the way, made his chops in Russia, too, in the 90s. I mean, again... People have forgotten this, but Russia in the 90s was the mission of America. It was the center of all American policy, and it was a catastrophe, you know, on the scale of the catastrophe of Iraq in the next decade. I mean, it's just, it's really unbelievable how much they fuck things up over and over and over. So Gordon goes from Russia reporting, hacking, to getting us into a war. Now he's with... The Wall Street Journal, I think he was trying to push the idea that Iran is close to getting the bomb. And, you know, if we don't do something in 3 months or 6 months or whatever the... Remember there was like a Thomas Friedman 6 months or something.
Iran has been 6 weeks from getting the bomb for this entire millennium so far. Probably before the millennium.
Yeah.
In fact, that was, I think, the one real regret in... nationalist or whatever you want to call them, circles in D.C., that Iraq spent so much of the U.S. military capital and its literal capital that they couldn't do Iran as well.
Right.
And some of them even had buyer's remorse, like, oh, I could have had an Iran.
Yeah, but, you know, that would have gone a lot worse.
It would have been an absolute nightmare. We would have lost armies. There would have been armies just completely swallowed up.
Yeah. New York Times executive editor Bill Keller, the I Can't Believe I'm a Hawk Club. Right? That's what he wrote. I Can't Believe I'm a Hawk Club. There was a lot of this in the Kosovo War.
This coy, disingenuous... I'm such a hawk. When did the New York Times meet a war it didn't lose?
I know. Huh?
I mean, there's this belief they have about themselves that normally I'm a nice guy. Yes. I hate the idea of war. That's a lie. They've always loved every war that America ever started. And he says, we reluctant hawks may disagree about ourselves. This pro-war stance. I can't help myself. What can I do?
I know. You know, I think the reason why you saw some of that with this war, you saw some of that with the Kosovo War too, which like the Susan Sontags, but they were much more, their rhetoric was like borderline evangelical religious about what a religious imperative it was to support NATO in the Kosovo War, and it was good versus evil and so on. But with this one, I think why you'd see this sort of, gosh, I can't believe I'm being a reluctant hawk here, was because deep down they all knew Bush was lying. Bush's people were lying. I mean, their stories were so ridiculous, you know? And like, for me, going to war just seemed absolutely crazy. It didn't matter whether it was because there were a few WMDs or not, or this or that. Like, I didn't even think that much about, I didn't believe the bullshit about a nuclear weapon. I didn't really care whether he had some WMDs because they weren't going to be able to do with anything with him anyway. Mm. But I have to admit, me, I really thought, wow, this WMD thing is also a giant lie. When Powell did his big speech before the UN, I don't know if you watched that, but I remember watching that, being really freaked out. Like, wow, this is, I've never seen any lying like this to like a body like that, so blatant in my life.
Basically, we're talking about younger viewers, we're talking about famous testimony where he holds up a little vial of white powder. It looked oddly like, you know, a coke dealer's spiel. Like,
yes.
This shit will fuck you up.
Yes, that's right. I picked this up right in front of a school playground. If we don't bomb the entire school at this moment. Yeah, that's exactly it. It was bizarre because you also kind of least expected that from Powell. You kind of had a sense that maybe if there's one, you know, grown up there, maybe it will be Powell. Not that he was a great guy. We know about Milei and all that stuff. But still, he had been reluctant about use of force in the past. And him doing that, it was like, holy shit, the whole country has gone completely insane. Yeah. And that's a weird, scary thing. Because then you're like, well, am I going to stand in the way of like this wave of elite insanity? And this is elite. This is top down. People like this same crowd likes to warn us about the dangers of populism and the deplorables and, you know, how dangerous they all are. But this was a slaughter that resulted in millions of people dead and displaced and wounded that was totally top down, you know, absolutely imposed.
That's really a point worth making many times. What is the elite's reputation, the punditocracy's reputation for having better taste than the nobodies based on? When were they right about anything? They certainly were wildly, unapologetically wrong about this. And then the next thing they cheered for, I guess, was Libya. That has been an unmitigated disaster.
Yeah.
Although they don't even acknowledge that. They sort of, in some awkward way, acknowledge that Iraq, well, didn't work out. Sorry about that.
I know.
But with Libya,
this is different.
We're not going to talk about that. That's it.
Well, and the way they sold it a lot, too, was this is women leading it. Samantha Power and Marie Slaughter, who also supported the Iraq invasion, as did Hillary. I don't know about Samantha Power, but as Susan Rice. Like, the whole thing was sold, at least as Obama White House people packaged it, as the first ever women's led humanitarian war. And, you know, what a great thing that's done for women. And it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
On the other hand, OTOH, and there wasn't much of this out there, hardly at all. Mm-hmm. John, for The Exile, The Warner, one of the first articles. So this is July 2002 from issue number 148. You publish this piece, Here Comes the Dumbass Sequel. And, you know, this was when it was starting to dawn on us that, you know, holy shit, they're not joking about actually invading Iraq, like the one country that had nothing to do with 9/11, to prove something or other. And here's, you know, here's what you write. So we're going to go back into Iraq now, this time they have to get rid of Saddam. The Israelis, for one, won't have it any other way. And the Bushes made it pretty obvious they're with the Israelis once and for all. I got to admit, I was very surprised at the time how much the Israelis were supposed to know the Middle East, but they had already started getting major brainworms. Like, they should have known that this war would go bad for us, and it should, anyway, just another, more stupidity everywhere. No Saddam means crazy Kurds, crazy Shiites, scared Saudis, angry Wahhabi loonies, desperate Palestinians. It means we go right up close to the old hornet's nest and hit it again with a big, big stick. And the stick's not going to be hitting a bubble, as Tom Friedman would have to believe. Anyway, boy, it sure is hard to predict what'll happen then, huh? You write, the Warnerd writes. And I know the hard part is making up a new happy Western Iraq. Won't happen, can't happen. Anybody who ain't thick as two planks knows that. So will they do it? Are they really that dumb? Well, all I can say is I used to live in Bakersfield and I knew a whole lot of Okies whose dads were in the business, the oil business, as they called it. And let me tell you, those boys were so goddamn dumb and so goddamn religious, they make the Saudis look like little bohemian university people. So yeah, they're dumb enough. They're way, way, way dumb enough. Yeehaw! Might as well enjoy it, I guess. There better be a lot of good gun camera shots from the A-10s because the rest of it ain't going to be much fun. I mean, I was the first one saying, like, this is going to be an incredibly bad idea.
Anyone really should have known that. United States had been in a lot of guerrilla wars recently in the lead up to this, hadn't done very well at any of them. But what that really did in the circles that counted was make them not want to think about guerrilla war much, because the most amazing thing about the first year of this war is that nobody is preparing for a possible guerrilla war. Nobody. It's like that was a bizarre idea that they laughed off. So the invasion begins March 20th, 2003. They move up from the south and the west. The first part does indeed go really well. They take Baghdad in less than 3 weeks, or that is, they occupy Baghdad. But that is the easy part. And the hard part is figuring out what you've occupied, because you don't have anybody who speaks the language. The few people you have as Iraqi liaisons are professional liars and spies, like Ahmed Chalabi. And your troops are completely blind. They don't have any clue what's going on there. Conditions are obviously ripe for a guerrilla war. But all, and I mean all the articles, all the sound bites were about how do we take Baghdad, or what do we do about those Iraqi tanks, or those Iraqi planes, or those Iraqi artillery pieces. Nothing about what happens after we occupy the cities. The amazing thing is, March 20th, 2003, the war begins. April 9th, American troops take Baghdad, and they do that famous toppling of the statue, the little photo op.
Which was staged, by the way, by the U.S. Army. The whole thing was staged by the PSYOPs people, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. It's like pointing an M16 at somebody, cheer! And May 1st, 2003, I had no idea this had happened so soon. U.S. President George W. Bush goes on an aircraft carrier and declares mission accomplished, an end to major combat operations. That is basically 6 weeks after combat operations start. Mission accomplished. No sense that there might be a guerrilla war.
Can I just add here? I'm sure, because I remember this was in the back of even my mind. I remember you were sure. I mean, we were both in Moscow at the time doing the exile, and you were absolutely sure there was going to be guerrilla warfare. And you were sort of drawing on, I mean, really what you were drawing on also was just everything you had studied and thought about and written about, you know, with Northern Ireland and other examples.
No,
of course,
Northern
plenty of
Ireland
examples.
Mostly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was not sure, I have to be honest, until I saw it, because people thought there was going to be something like that in Kosovo. But Kosovo obviously was hugely different, hugely different. But I know the Kosovo precedent, it's only because there were some people warning about it, that if U.S. quote-unquote boots on the ground, right? Remember, the U.S., NATO didn't put so-called boots on the ground. It was all air for the entire war, got Yeltsin to sell out Milosevic, and that caused the Serbian will to collapse because they had no outside support anymore. That was it. And so they caved. And, but, you know, the huge difference was 90% of the population there was ethnic Albanian, wanted us there, absolutely wanted it. So this wasn't like, you know, so that's already reason number one why it's so massively different from Iraq. They actually wanted us there and wanted us to protect them and still like having us there. Most of them do anyway. I mean, a large enough portion of them do. And especially because Serbia still exists right next to them, and then northern Kosovo is still Serbian controlled mostly. Another difference is it's so small. I mean, if you've been to Kosovo, it's like this little valley. It's like this bowl, you know, that's so, I mean, you could keep an eye on every little thing there. And you know, the largest U.S. base, at least in the world at the time, Camp Bondsteel was built there, and all the NATO allies had bases. So it was just, but I think to the political people who thought at that time, we know better than the military people, it was like, they said that about Kosovo, right, and there was no problem. There's not going to be a problem here because everybody just wants to be us anyway. History's ended. We are the end of history. Everybody, except for a few dead-enders, wants to be us anyway. Yeah, it's like the quote from Full Metal Jacket where the guy famously says to Matthew Modine, inside of every G-O-O-K is an American trying to get out. And that really was the thinking of people. And I think all the liberals who hugely supported the Kosovo War weren't like, they just deferred to them. I think they didn't know or believe in a guerrilla war either, because it seemed obvious to everybody that everybody wants to be American.
Yeah.
You know.
And on that happy note, we'll stop here.
On that happy note, I guess we could stop here and then we can continue, because we have a whole bunch of people we want to...
Deserving targets.
Yeah, deserving targets, people whose quotes we want to get out there, big, small, and in between. So we'll do that in the next episode, right?
Yep.
All right, good.
All right.
Thanks, John, Brennan. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, talk to everybody. You soon, John. Bye.
Bye.